This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We have a full hour of national politics today, and there is no shortage of topics. So why don't we just get started? Joining us now is the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
And in the studio with me are Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Welcome back, Dr. Bloom.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU Senior Political Analyst Howard Wilkinson. Howard, how are you?
I'm great.
Awesome. So before we get to the day's news, which we could probably all use just a moment to think about where to go next with the topics that have just been exploding all over the stratosphere of news, we do start with the Political Junkie trivia question. So Ken, tell the audience what it is this month.
Okay, Michael, and hello, Howard, and hello, Rachel. So the question is... So I was thinking about this, you know, Nikki Haley has been, once upon a time was a Trump critic, and now she's been an unwavering defender for the president. And so what followed with that, everybody's saying, well, okay, now they're going to dump Mike Pence as vice president next year and put Nikki Haley on the ticket, which is crazy. But then it reminds me of a good trivia question. Who was the last elected vice president dumped from the ticket, and who was he replaced by?
Who was the last elected vice president dumped from the ticket, and who was he replaced by? We'll give Howard and Rachel an opportunity to write down their answers, and we'll visit that a little later on. And for those of you listening, if you have an answer to that question, who was the last elected vice president dumped from the ticket, and who was he replaced by, call us 513-419-7100. One lucky caller with the correct answer. Ken, we'll go home with what?
The very desirable Political Junkie button.
So exciting. So give us a call, 513-419-7100. That number is also the one you want to use if you want to join this conversation today. We have so much to talk about, and we definitely want to hear from you, your comments and your questions about impeachment, Ukraine, Iran, the Democratic primary as it goes on. Call us at 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets and get some of those into the show as well. So what should we talk about, y'all? I mean, it has been a nutty day. Let's start with this, because there was some late breaking news, and this is from the Washington Post. The White House violated federal law in its hold on security aid to Ukraine last year, according to a decision by a congressional watchdog released on Thursday. The Government Accountability Office, a nonpartisan agency that reports to Congress, found the Trump administration violated a law that governs how the White House disburses money approved by Congress. So, Ken, this news comes out the day that the impeachment trial in the Senate takes its first formal steps, with the swearing in of the Chief Justice and the 100 senators who will serve as jurors. This is related to the issue at hand that led the House to impeach the president. Does this mean anything?
Well, it depends on whether you're somebody who follows the law or not. I mean, I don't know how shocking this is, because basically this is the arguments we've heard in those House impeachment hearings that went on and on by many members of the government. Not everybody, because the president blocked so many from testifying. But those who did testify said that the president, with his emissaries, Rudy Giuliani and others, went to the government of Ukraine and said, we're going to hold up hundreds of millions of dollars in military assistance unless you open up an investigation into Hunter Biden, the son of Joe Biden, who Hunter Biden worked for this energy company in Ukraine. So what the GAO said today is basically what the House impeachment managers said. And when they brought over their articles of impeachment to the Senate yesterday, that's what they'll be debating for the next couple of weeks in the Senate with a vote, during the trial.
And Dr. Bloom, the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, is described as a nonpartisan agency that reports to Congress. So this shouldn't be characterized, I suppose, as Democratic talking points, but it does seem to confirm Democratic talking points. How do you see this agency's decision playing in the Senate?
I think it's... We could view it in a similar way that we view some of the judicial decisions, right? So it depends who's hearing it or who's interpreting it. But right now, anything that seems to bolster the case for impeachment will be interpreted by Mitch McConnell, at the very least, as a Democratic talking point. Now, of course, you have a lot of confirmation bias there. If you insist it is, it is. But I'm I'm skeptical about whether one more piece of information, as bipartisan as it might be, could actually tip the scales for someone like McConnell.
And Howard, we've heard from some Republican senators that they don't want any more evidence introduced, that it's not part of the process, that what they are to consider is what was delivered to them by the House, even though what has been characterized as new evidence has emerged. This is not necessarily new evidence. This is confirmation of the existing evidence.
Yes. What it is confirmation citing a specific law, 1974 Act of Congress, which I believe, if I remember correctly, came out of Nixon and his impoundments. And that was where the law was written. So now you can go in and say, okay, he violated this law. It's not, supposition. It's not saying, oh, this is unconstitutional or whatever, but there's a specific law being cited that the Trump administration and Trump himself has violated.
Nancy Pelosi.
I was going to say, this is not the new evidence that Republicans are fearing and Democrats are talking about. The new evidence regarding Lev Parnas,
right.
and the stuff that he says that President Trump knew of all the efforts by Giuliani and others to make that deal regarding Biden and the Ukraine government. But what the GAO is doing is confirming what the Democrats have already discovered. What the Republicans are most angry about is new evidence that Adam Schiff and other Democrats are saying that are going to be added to the argument in the Senate trial.
Or whatever John Bolton might have to add to this.
Well, of course, that's questionable. Yeah,
I know. Yeah,
we should say that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat from California, said today that this report from the GOA, quote, reinforces again the need for documents and eyewitnesses in the Senate. There still seems to be a reluctance to move in that direction. And Ken, you referenced Lev Parnas, the former associate of former New York City Mayor Rudolph W. Giuliani, who is serving as a personal attorney to President Donald J. Trump. And Parnas appeared on MSNBC's Rachel Maddow show just last night. And man, he took a match to everyone. Ken, what should the reaction be to the revelations that Lev Parnas let out last night?
Well, the reaction that should be is the same reaction that should have come with everybody who's testified, including the former ambassador and the former NSA people and all the people who testified before the House impeachment inquiry. But but whether that reaction will be shared by Republicans is very, very questionable. For the Senate to agree to hear witnesses during the impeachment trial, there will be a vote. Apparently, Mitch McConnell agreed there will be a vote. And right now, there may be four Republicans, because that's what you need. You need four Republicans to vote with all the Democrats for them to call witnesses. And right now, Susan Collins, Lisa Murkowski, Lamar Alexander, who's retiring, and Mitt Romney, who is a longtime critic of the president, seem to be saying that we will vote with the Democrats. At least that's what Tim Kaine is saying, that they will vote with the Democrats to call for witnesses. And if that's the case, that could be another, maybe a game changer. Not that you'll get 20 Republicans to vote for conviction, but the fact that maybe more and more people will see what this is. Because ultimately, the audience for the impeachment trial in the Senate is not the senators. It's really the voters in November.
I want to quote some coverage from the Washington Post as it relates to Lev Parnas in some of the materials that was released by him and his attorney. There was a calendar entry released that included a scheduled breakfast with President Trump in New York on September 26th. This is, quote, after the public revelation of a whistleblower complaint about a call the president had with his Ukrainian counterpart. And I want to note something that Lev Parnas said on Rachel Maddow's show on Wednesday on MSNBC. He said, quote, President Trump knew exactly what was going on. He was aware of all of my movements. I wouldn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani or the president. I have no intent. I have no reason to speak to any of these officials. So with that known now, Dr. Bloom, what can the Senate actually do in terms of mechanisms afforded to them under the Constitution if there are senators who think this amounts to interesting materials or something that should at least be considered in the context of this trial? Are they able to do that?
They are. It would take a simple majority to vote to allow those witnesses. And that is what the Democrats wanted to decide on before the trial. And they didn't really get their way. But at any point during the trial, 51 senators could ask for witnesses, evidence of any sort. And of course, at the end of it, the Senate has the final mechanism, which would be to vote for impeachment, even though that would take 2/3.
Let me ask you, Howard, if the president right now were Hillary Clinton, but the storyline, the narrative and the facts of the case were all still the same, including the makeup of the Senate currently, would there be majority votes to bring in this kind of evidence?
Well, yeah, I think so.
So what is that? What doesn't that say something pretty significant about this process?
Yes, it does. And just the other day on this program, you were interviewing Rob Portman, and Rob Portman was talking about the difference between 1998 with the Clinton impeachment trial and the political atmosphere here in 2020. And it's vastly different. In 1998, there were a handful of Republicans, not a lot of Republicans, but a handful of Republicans who, you know, said, no, this is not up to the standards of impeachment and removal from office. And now it's just like a totally stark divide, except for the four that you were talking about who might vote to allow these witnesses. But they can at any point they, you know, want to. And Portman was basically saying the same thing that Mitch has agreed to, that after the opening statements, after some questions by the senators, there will be a vote on this.
Ken, I want to ask you, it looks like President Trump is going to get an investigation in Ukraine by Ukrainian officials, but not exactly the investigation he wants. This is also related to comments and materials released by Lev Parnas. One of those documents includes a May 9, 2018 letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, to then House Representative Pete Sessions, a Republican from Texas, calling for former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, to be removed. She ultimately was removed, and now the Ukraine government is going to be investigating whether there was some possible surveillance going on of her before she was dismissed. Again, this is all relatively new information, Ken. How can this play out?
Well, this is controversial in itself because the person who's alleging the surveillance of Yovanovitch is this guy named Robert Hyde, mm-hmm. who's a Republican congressional candidate in Connecticut, who has been involuntarily committed for mental problems. So he is part of that Lev Parnas trove of new documents and evidence. Whether that's real or not, I mean, Hyde says, well, he was drunk. He said he was on Fox News, and obviously somebody got to him because when he went on Fox News, he said, oh, I was just kidding around. We were drunk and we didn't mean it. But the fact is that if you look at the emails between Hyde and Parnas, it looks like that Yovanovitch was trailed, was monitored when her computer was on, when it wasn't on, and that will be investigated by Ukraine. And so, I mean, you know, I don't know what it'll take for some people to say, my goodness, there is a there. But right now, half the country is not going to agree to believe it, and perhaps not even half the Senate is.
We might have lost Ken for just a moment, and if we did, we'll reconnect. Do we have Ken? Okay, we'll try to reconnect with Ken and bring him back in because we've got a lot of people on the line who want to answer his trivia question, and we're going to get to that and get to some of these answers that we can't wait to hear. But what Ken was saying just before we lost him was that half the country's not going to believe it, Dr. Bloom, and I have to wonder why that is. If these are presented as facts, because they are, why is that not digestible for people?
You could think of it as growing strength of partisanship. So we have weaker parties, as in the parties have less control over something like Donald Trump getting the nomination, but people whose identity is more wrapped up in partisanship, And we know from some recent scholarship by Liliana Mason and others that that's particularly strong among Republicans. There are so many overlapping identities. And when that becomes the case, not only do you seek out information that feeds into what you already believe, but you have confirmation and disconfirmation bias. And I'm honestly not sure what it would take to achieve that tipping point we had with Nixon. If this were Nixon, that would have already happened.
Yeah. We address this point a lot on this program as it relates to impeachment because of the way that public opinion shifted during the Nixon impeachment discussions, because once the hearings started to be televised, people were glued and they absorbed what was said. They accepted it as fact and it changed their minds. We don't really live in that world anymore because there is so much media that can either provide disinformation or at least alter our interpretation and understanding. And they can do it in a very manipulative, pseudo-credible way. And so it also seems to speak, Howard, to this idea that politics is sport now, and it's like cheering for your favorite team, and there's nothing anyone can say about it. My team is better than yours, and my team just needs to score more points than yours.
Right, and it's almost blood sport. I mean, it's, you know, in the case of Nixon, there were a series of events that took place that slowly, not quickly, but slowly turned public opinion against Nixon. Saturday Night Massacre was one of them. The conviction of the seven was another one. When the smoking gun tape came out that actually had him saying, okay, stop the investigation, that was the one that just basically collapsed any support that he had whatsoever, even in the Senate.
I believe we have Ken back. Hi, Ken.
I'm never leaving you again.
Oh, we're so glad. And let's let our listeners know now that you will actually be able to see Ken in the flesh. It's February 5th.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing our show live in the studios at WCET. So that,
And when we have a trivia question, the prize will be a Political Junkie T-shirt.
Oh,
like that.
Man, I didn't know you had the budget for that kind of thing. Yeah. It's exciting to hear.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
let's
out of Howard's pocket.
Very generous, Howard.
Right, yeah.
Let's get to the trivia question. We got a lot of people who want to weigh on this. Again, the question, who was the last elected vice president dumped from the ticket, and who was he replaced by? Let's check out some of our callers and see what they have to say. We'll go first to Phil. Hi, Phil. What's your answer to the question?
Hello?
Hi, Phil. Do you have an answer for the trivia question?
Yes. Spiro Agnew.
Ken?
Spiro Agnew was not dumped from the ticket. He did resign because of crimes in 1973. He was accused of and later convicted of taking bribes while vice president and as governor of Maryland and as Baltimore County executive. But he was not dumped from the ticket. He resigned his job.
All right, Phil, I'm sorry. Great guess, not correct. Man, the early 70s must have been wild. I'm sorry to have missed that. I know Dr. Bloom, you must be as
great
well.
Great clothing, too.
Wild, wild times in America. Let's see who else might have an answer for us. Let's go now to Rick. Hi, Rick. What's your answer to the trivia question?
Hi. This is close to his answer, but I believe it was Nelson Rockefeller who was replaced by Bob Dole.
Ken.
Well, Nelson Rockefeller was replaced by Bob Dole, but Nelson Rockefeller was not an elected vice president. He was picked by Gerald Ford, confirmed by Congress, but not elected.
Okay, you got tripped up on a technicality, Rick. Great guess, and one guess that I would have thought was correct. Thanks for calling in. We appreciate the effort nonetheless. Let's go now to Bill. Hi, Bill. What's your answer?
Hi. It was Henry Wallace who, in 1944, was replaced by Harry Truman.
Ken?
That is the correct answer.
Oh! Bill, well done.
Way to go, Bill.
And talk about how that was so historically significant. Franklin Roosevelt was dying in 1944. He dumped Henry Wallace, who was a real left-winger, a pro-Moscow official. He was dumped for the ticket in 44. Harry Truman, the senator from Missouri, was added, and Harry Truman became president like 4 months after Inauguration Day.
You never know what life is going to throw at you. Bill, stay on the line. Our producers will get your information and send you that coveted Political Junkie button. We'll play again
on February 5th. Hope you'll tune in for that. We also want to take your calls as it relates to all of the topics we're exploring so far today, including our upcoming discussion on the state of the race on the Democratic side. There's still an election going on for president as well. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It is the Political Junkie Show today, a full hour of national politics. And we are naturally joined by the Political Junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, thanks for being with us. Oh, no, we've lost Ken again just in time for me to introduce him. We're just having a couple of technical difficulties. No big deal. We'll reconnect with him. And fortunately for me, I'm not alone in the studio here in downtown Cincinnati. I'm joined by Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thanks so much for being back with us.
Thanks.
And we also have WVXU Senior Political Analyst Howard Wilkinson. Howard, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. We'll stay here with you.
I really appreciate that because today is so fast moving and there's so much going on nationally and internationally, but it is a historic day today. I know we've had a lot of historic days recently. The president has been impeached. The articles have been delivered now to the Senate. And as I understand it, at 2 o'clock this afternoon, Chief Justice John Roberts will be sworn in to take his role as the presiding officer in the Senate trial phase of the impeachment process. And also at around 2 o'clock, all 100 senators will be sworn in as jurors. Howard, talk about the historic significance of today, if you can put it into some kind of context. We haven't had one of these events in more than 20 years. So how should the nation feel right now? I'm not sure that it should feel the way that it does feel, but what should we feel like?
Well, we should feel that this is a momentous occasion. This is not a game. This is not, as you say, a sporting contest. This is serious business, and we can only hope that they all take it seriously. Part of the oath that they'll take is to listen to the facts impartially and make a decision. And whatever decision they make, that's it. That's fine. But, you know, you want them to be serious about the job. And that's why this idea that Rudy and Donald Trump apparently were pushing with Mitch McConnell for a while, that they immediately go into session and somebody makes a motion to dismiss the whole case out of hand without hearing a word of testimony or argument from either side, just didn't fly because enough Republican senators, including Rob Portman, who said it on this show the other day, wouldn't go along with that. They said, no, that's not right. You know, we have an obligation to at least hear some evidence and some testimony on this.
And we want to hear from you as well, your thoughts on the impeachment process or the Democratic primary. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. Dr. Bloom, you're a professor at Miami University. Can you shed some light for us on how younger Americans, college-age students, those who are young but able to vote, how are they talking about this?
The overwhelming sense I've had from my students is almost an unwillingness to engage. So they're very conflict phobic to them. It's a problem if people disagree. The word partisan is bad to them. They all want to be moderates no matter what the two polls are. And I think this is a very difficult issue to be in the middle on because an impeachment vote is ultimately up or down. And I try to encourage them to get more involved in politics because what they're responding to is the culture war era of partisan discord that was so pervasive in the 90s. But of course, if most of the electorate doesn't vote, none of these elected officials really ever have pressure on them. And then the branches don't work the way they're supposed to if you have partisan collusion between, say, the executive and the legislative branch with only some of the electorate participating.
I wonder if that gives us an indication then that maybe we're close to the end of this particularly contentious cycle in American politics.
I think something has to break. We're either facing the end of the Madisonian constitutional system, which is, you know, that's a dour prediction, but I don't think it's out of place, or we're going to be affected by generational replacement, if nothing else.
Ken Rudin is back with us, this time on an old-fashioned landline like you would have been when you called in the Nixon impeachment news. So we're glad to have you yet again in a new way, Ken.
No, this is actually the phone I used to call Lassie. I ring it, I turn it around, I get the operator, and then I speak to Timmy and Lassie on the other line.
Well, I don't get the reference, but I'm sure it's hilarious.
It is, yes.
Oh, yeah. You young people, well, you youngsters.
You kids.
Oh, my goodness.
I know Timmy's in the well.
I get it. We did get a caller, Ken, who left us a message, who wanted to say whatever happened to the incident.
Ken Rudin.
We got this message from a caller who wanted to say, whatever happened to the incident when President Trump met with Putin privately, and why isn't that being looked at? And so the way that I want to interpret that question and reframe it for you is, my goodness, there's just been so many strange developments over the course of the Trump presidency and things that have caused concern for people who might be in some type of investigative role. Russia is not the main focus here. The Russian collusion that was part of our vocabulary for so long, but yet in a way, Russia still looms because of its connections to Ukraine, its threats to Ukraine. Do you think that having these issues develop one after the other is impacting the way Americans feel about where we are right now?
You know something, that's a great question. I think everybody's just numb. I just think we're numb by one after another after another. And I think at the same time, when Donald Trump keeps saying it's fake, it's false, it's a hoax, it's a witch hunt, and you have support for the media at record lows, which is very, very alarming, I think it's just nothing changes. Nothing seems to change. And, you know, I don't know what it would take, you know, the famous Donald Trump 2015 line that I could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and my supporters won't leave me. That seems to be the case. And you know that if there's going to be an acquittal in the Senate, which is almost, I would say, 99% likely, after the acquittal, his people will go around the country and just saying those Democrats are part of this partisanship that's trying to overturn the democratically elected, the Democratic election of 2016. So I think people are just weary. You know, the question is whether people will come out and vote, which Democrats are hoping they will. But if they don't believe that their vote matters, if they don't believe their vote is really going to count, I think the dissatisfaction and the disillusionment is at a peak, and it's still growing. And I don't see it abating anytime soon.
Howard, what do you think the political ramifications could be after the dust settles, if it ever does, on this impeachment trial? If it is a foregone conclusion that the president will be acquitted, then let's accept that. But what then is the messaging? This is an election year.
Yeah, the messaging, I think, has already started, actually. I mean, Nancy Pelosi says it all the time, says, look, no matter what happens in the Senate trial, this is a president who has been impeached. And, you know, there are specific charges against him. I think, you know, Ken's right that many people are numb to this. I think they're more weary than numb, though. Actually, I think they're just tired of this, you know, constant bombardment of, you know, every day. Like today, I mean, we've had six different stories, you know, pop out at least.
Yeah, and Mitch McConnell just sent a statement as we were going on the air that, you know, celebrating the passage of the USMCA, the updated
right.
North American Free Trade Agreement. So, I mean, there's still major legislation that's moving through on top of all of this.
Well, there is. And one of the things that an impeachment trial does, it stops that. Stops the passage of legislation.
And it stops both Republican and Democrat interest in this respect, because there are Democratic senators who are seeking the Democratic nomination for president, that they may be taken off the campaign trail for a certain amount of time.
Yep.
And Mitch McConnell, who is probably, you know, regardless of what you think of his politics, politically speaking, a very skilled tactical politician and has been able to reshape the American court system by pushing through judges. While all of this was going on in the House, he took advantage of the opportunity to keep
his agenda moving in the Senate. That will have to come to a stop as well, it appears. 513-419-7100 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's go to Jackie on the line. Hi, Jackie. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment a couple of things. I was a little put off by Pelosi's decision to withhold these articles of impeachment. Seems really inconvenient to do so at this point, right when we're getting ready to head into Iowa caucus, and we have senators that are running that are going to be now, you know, essentially off the campaign trail. I really don't understand that calculation. But and then my other comment was about Elizabeth Warren and her, you know, conveniently coming out with this on Bernie Sanders this week. It really disappointed me. Just my opinion, it seemed very calculated and a political maneuver. I mean, if she had this problem with what he said in 2018, why did she wait so long? And it really doesn't seem to me like something that Bernie Sanders would say. Maybe it was taken out of context, but anyhow, that's my comments. I love your show. And thanks for everything.
Jackie, thank you so much. We appreciate the call. We will address both of those. And I want to thank you because you've given me the opportunity to transition now. So we will talk about the articles of impeachment and then we will transition into talk about the Democratic primary. So thank you very much for that call. Let's start with Jackie's question about Nancy Pelosi holding the articles of impeachment for as long as she did, whether it was the right move or whether it was not the right move. Dr. Bloom, what's your perspective on that?
I think that's a tough one. I mean, Pelosi's received a lot of criticism from members of her own caucus for this. I'm slightly more sympathetic to her decision just from the perspective of what she was up against, timing, holiday, all of that intervened. And then there was a real way in which she believed that there would be witnesses coming forward who were not allowed to come forward by Trump. So a lot of the evidence wasn't heard when House Democrats thought it would be heard. And the only way to delay that or to kind of force Mitch McConnell out of his dismissal position was to wait. So it might not be the most popular position if your goal is for impeachment to wrap up as quickly as possible. But if your goal is Pelosi's goal, which is to see it through and get as much evidence as possible, I think it was an unavoidable decision.
And Ken, let me bring you in on that, because here we are 20 years into the new century. And Nancy Pelosi will be one of the historic political figures of this era in American history. And like McConnell, she's a very skilled politician as well. It's probably safe to assume that she did not make the decisions that she made related to this lightly. But if the argument from the Republicans in the Senate is that the House is delivering weak articles of impeachment, is it not then the case that perhaps these articles are weak if they are because they didn't get all of the evidence or the witnesses that they had wanted?
Well, I mean, that's the as Dr. Bloom said, that's exactly the reason why she hesitated and held up for as long as she did. You know, the funny thing is, so many Democrats ran for Congress in 2018 promising they wouldn't vote for Nancy Pelosi for Speaker because she was, you know, she was old, she was outdated, she was no longer effective. She's probably the most effective Speaker and the most savvy Speaker that I could think of in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I think she met her match in Mitch McConnell, the fact that she wanted to wait him out because hoping for some concessions on the terms of the debate in the Senate, she didn't get it. And when members of her own caucus, her own party, like Dianne Feinstein, like other Democrats, said, enough is enough already, buckled in. But as she said, and talking about Rachel's sympathy for Nancy Pelosi, as she and Adam Schiff said, they were just trying to get more agreement on witnesses and more agreement on documents. And if anybody's holding up the trial, it's the White House, who's refusing to allow aides to testify, refusing to send along documents. I think in the end she was outsmarted by McConnell and had to give in, but I understand exactly why she was doing it.
Okay, so we do want to address the other question that Jackie had as it relates to Democratic presidential candidates and U.S. Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. We want to talk a little bit about that debate in Iowa this week. We want to talk about the polls and where the race appears to stand now. We want to talk about the conversation around the fact that
the candidates on stage in that debate this week were all white. That's something that's becoming a narrative as well. So we want to hear from you at 513-419-7100. We'll pick up that part of the conversation next. Before we take this little break, though, Howard and Dr. Bloom, I forgot to ask whether you got the trivia question right. Ken's trivia question about who was the last elected vice president to be replaced on the ticket by the president in the next campaign. And Dr. Bloom, I think you forgot to participate, so that's okay, right?
I also didn't know.
Okay, so that's honest and fair. Thank you for being honest. I didn't know either. I always guess via email with Ken before he gives me the answer. I was wrong. I said Alvin Barkley from Kentucky because...
Yeah, of course.
That was wrong. Not a bad guess. I was in the right era.
No, you're right.
But Howard close. Wilkinson, you were right.
Absolutely.
Henry Wallace got
Henry
it right.
Wallace. And for the same, for the reasons, you know, that were stated. I mean, he was just too far out there for FDR running for a fourth term. And people were starting to understand that, you know, FDR was not in the best of health, not in the best of shape. And they were looking for somebody who was kind of a centrist machine type politician who could bring some votes in.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. I'm joined for the monthly politics show with the political junkie, Ken Rudin, who's on the phone with us. Ken, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And Ken will be in Cincinnati in early February. We've got details at WVXU.org. We will be doing a live broadcast from WCET Studios downstairs, doing the show there. And I think we've also got an event scheduled at my alma mater in Highland Heights, the Harvard of Campbell County, Northern Kentucky University.
Absolutely.
Looking forward to getting over there and hanging out and having a panel discussion there. That should be a lot of fun. And in the studio with me now are Miami University Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Thank you for sticking around.
Yep.
And WVXU senior political analyst Howard Wilkinson. Thank you as well. So before we went to break, we were talking about the Democratic presidential primary. And the question that we got from the caller was specific to this feud between Senators Bernie Sanders and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. You know, these feuds are boring to me a lot of the time. But it seems, Ken, that this particular feud where Elizabeth Warren suggested that Bernie Sanders once told her a couple years back that a woman could not be elected president. He's denied that. She stands by it. It came up in the debate, was handled kind of strangely by the CNN moderators during the debate, and then led to a very tense and awkward moment between those two candidates as the cameras remained on them after the debate had concluded. Before we dive into those details, Ken, what does this tell us about the state of the race if Elizabeth Warren is possibly trying to get some negative news out there about Bernie Sanders?
Well, it's the kind of thing that the media and those who, people who love to have conflict and fights among candidates have been wishing for. Everybody's been saying, well, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren represent the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Certainly they can't both run for president without beating each other up. And so the media would have been looking for this for the longest time, which is very unfortunate, given the fact that Elizabeth Warren is not the kind of person who usually attacks her opponents. Now, in fairness, whatever you think about Bernie Sanders, and a lot of people who love Bernie Sanders, look at all his supporters and the money he's raised, there are still some people who blame him in some way for Hillary Clinton's defeat in 2016. Now, we could talk about that for hours and hours, who's responsible, but the fact is that he comes into 2020 with some baggage about women. Now, having said all that, there is a question of what the question really is. Is it true that a woman cannot be elected president, or is it true that a woman cannot defeat Donald Trump? Those are two separate questions, and both Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders have two different understandings of the conversation.
Well, they certainly had a different understanding of what each of them said when questioned about it in the debate. According to the audio that was released by CNN, as the mics picked up what they were saying after the debate had concluded, Senator Warren approached Bernie Sanders. He had his hand outstretched for a post-debate handshake. She did not accept it, and she is quoted, as she's heard as saying, "I think you called me a liar on national TV."
Right.
Sanders says, "What?" She says that again. "I think you called me a liar on national TV." Sanders tries to wave it off. "Let's not do it right here, but if you want to have that discussion, we'll have it." And then he basically says, "You called me a liar," and then kind of walked away from her, all the while an awkward Tom Steyer is standing there having his most interesting moment of the debate probably as well. But Dr. Bloom, what I want to ask you about this particular moment was the way the CNN moderators framed the question, because it seemed quite strange, because it was a CNN report that first put this story out there. So it may have been just them standing by their own reporting and the way that they characterized it, but they asked Bernie Sanders whether he had said this thing about whether a woman could be elected. He said, no, I never said it. The next question went to Elizabeth Warren from the same moderator, and the question was posed as, how did you feel when Bernie Sanders said this to you? Why would they do that?
I mean, they could very well just be trying to generate conflict or something exciting or interesting. The moderating on that debate was a little bit lackluster as it was, so that didn't strike me as particularly odd. The bigger issue is, to me, the substance of the comment. So the fact that it's getting so much traction speaks to a lot of people's maybe uncertainty about whether a woman really could be elected. And if people don't think a woman can be elected, then a woman can't, right? And that, to me, is what this whole kerfluffle is about.
Howard, this Democratic primary has had some dust-up moments, I think, as early back as the first debate with the busing issue and Kamala Harris getting that initial bounce that faded rather quickly when she scored a point on Joe Biden, who has sort of been like a Teflon Joe in this because some of these other candidates are going for each other rather than for him. Right. But it's been a mostly peaceful primary, has it not?
It has, for the most part. And even in this case, when she was asked that question in the debate, I thought her response was perfectly reasonable. You know, she said, well, look around the stage. You know, there are male candidates here who have lost 10 elections. There are two females, Amy Klobuchar and myself, who have never lost a race. So, you know, I thought if she had left it at that.
If it was her campaign who developed the story in the media, she did set herself up to have that moment that was pretty well critically praised by the punditry class after she said it.
And that was fine. That was, you know, that was an appropriate response. Now, this thing that happened afterwards, while the music is still playing and the people were, you know.
She wanted to throw hands.
Yeah. And she has to understand, I mean, there are such a thing as hot mics, live microphones, everywhere. And you have to be very careful about what you say.
And you have to assume that that might be why Bernie Sanders said, let's not do this here.
Let's not do this here.
Still on the air.
And Tom Steyer is standing there and said, I just wanted to shake hands with Bernie.
He did. And that was the hardest part to watch was when Tom is heard on the audio saying, oh, I just wanted to say hi, Bernie. And Bernie said, oh, good, hi.
And the
whole thing just reminded me of stuff that we used to do in the playground and as we were kids. And I said, oh, you're a liar. No, you're not a liar.
You know, it does get petty sometimes, even when the stakes are as high as they are.
And they're very high.
Phone lines now. We've got Chris on the line. Chris, what's your question or comment?
Well, you're commenting, everybody, you are, and they've seen it on the news, on how it's only white people on stage. I think that points to a problem with the Democratic Party, that they are not forwarding black candidates that black people will support.
Okay. Chris, we appreciate that call very much, and we'll hang up and we'll let the panel address that. The reference is that most of the candidates of color, this was originally a historically diverse field of candidates. Of course, there were a lot of candidates. People had to find their lanes and their path to money and support that could be sustainable across this very expensive and challenging race. But Ken, on Tuesday this week, when the debate took place, there were no people of color on stage, and there were just white people up there. The highest number of black support, according to polls, is going to Joe Biden, despite the previous options of some African-American candidates or Hispanic candidates. Ken, what do you think is happening here?
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who have complained, including Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, two African-American candidates who dropped out of the race. They've complained that the way the rules are written, that it just hurts candidates who don't have a huge financial power base and things like that, and that's why they weren't doing great in the polls. Although, to be honest, Kamala Harris dropped out of the race when she was still qualifying for the debates. So to say that the DNC forced her out, that's not really fair. But the fact is, and I think the questioner addressed this, is that Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, when they came to the race, they were expected to appeal to the significant African-American support that basically gave Hillary Clinton the nomination over Bernie Sanders. But the fact is, because of his loyal stewardship for 8 years as Barack Obama's vice president, Joe Biden has that black support. Now, remember, in 2008, Hillary Clinton had the black support over Barack Obama until we saw that Barack Obama was able to win votes. And then many African Americans said, "Wait a second! I'm going to go away from Hillary Clinton, who's long been supported by, whose family is long supported by black voters. But they'll go to Obama." That didn't happen because these candidates dropped out before we even saw what the voters wanted. The question is whether African Americans will stay with Joe Biden. But for all his what I think has been pretty lackluster debate performances, the black voters stayed with him and has not decreased at all. His national support, even though it's not a national primary, has stayed with him as well. So don't blame the rules for this. African Americans can support whomever they want. They've decided to support Joe Biden, and that really hurt Cory Booker and Kamala Harris.
And Howard, I think that perhaps the reason Biden has remained relatively steady in the polls, leading nationally, still leading among the large black voter base, and still leading or within striking distance in some of the early state polling, may have to do with that connection to Barack Obama, as Ken Rudin suggested. But I'm also wondering, in your view, whether he might represent a return to what some people may characterize as normalcy, whereas the big ideas, the college tuition, college loan debt, health care for all,
right,
while they are important to a lot of people, are they the most important thing, or is removing Trump from office the most important thing? Is that where he's winning?
That is, I think, where he's winning. And I think that is the whole problem here with this Democratic primaries and the caucuses. They can't seem to get focused on the idea that job number one for them this year is to remove Donald Trump from office. Then they can have these debates inside the Democratic Party about, you know, where the Democratic Party should go, what the priorities should be. You look at African-American voters, obviously they have some strong feelings about Joe Biden because of his relations with Barack Obama. But I think it goes beyond that. There are candidates who are on that stage, the white candidates, who are probably looking at potential running mates from among those.
Certainly Julian Castro came out and endorsed Elizabeth Warren.
Exactly. One of those people, Julian Castro, Booker, you know, even Harris, will be looked at seriously as a running mate.
And we should note that Asian-American Andrew Yang is still, yes, in the race. He didn't qualify. Tulsi Gabbard, who's non-white, did not, right, qualify for the debate. Deval Patrick, the African-American former governor of Massachusetts, also did not qualify for, yes, the debate. The Iowa caucuses are coming up. I've got 30 seconds left. I'm going to run through the three of you really quick with a prediction. Ken, who wins the Iowa caucus?
Marianne Williamson. I have no idea. I have no idea. The polls say Bernie. The polls also say Biden. No clue. Iowans always make up their minds at the last second.
Rachel?
Ken is right. The Iowans like to surprise people. So,
all right,
so I'll say Buttigieg.
Buttigieg. Howard?
That's what I'd say, too, if you force me to do that, but I really hate to make this prediction.
All right.
Because Iowans are a different breed.
Well, we'll see soon enough. The votes are coming in. Ken Rudin, the political junkie, thanks for being with us, and we will see you in early February.
I can't wait.
All right.
And to Dr. Rachel Bloom from Miami University and from Howard Wilkinson right here at WVXU, thank you too as well.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks.